You're listening to the Thank God for Nostra podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Thank God for Nostra podcast. My name is Jordan Bush. I am the executive director of TGFB Media.
And my name is John. I am also known as Hoddlebot. I am the developer of the Coracle.social Nostra client. And today we are going to be beginning another book study. It's going to go for a couple weeks. We're going to be reading Marshall McLuhan's Understanding Media. And to kind of set that up, we're going to read a quote from his book, which is likewise a quote from our favorite book, not specifically Psalm 115, maybe, but from the Bible. This is Psalm 115, 4 through 8. Their idols are silver and gold, the work of men's hands. They have mouths, but they speak not. Eyes they have, but they see not. They have ears, but they hear not. Noses have they, but they smell not. They have hands, but they handle not. Feet have they, but they walk not. Neither speak they through their throat. They that make them shall be like unto them. Yea, everyone that trusteth in them.
Based, we included the based KJV. For those of you guys who you're like, what on earth did I just teleport back to 200 years ago? You may have.
You really got to emphasize the Psalms, man. That's the way to read them for sure.
Yeah.
So what does this have to do with media? What do idols have to do with media? It seems like as good a place as any to kick things off.
Yeah. So, I mean, McLuhan is famous for this phrase, the medium is the message. If you know anything about Marshall McLuhan, you probably know that quote. It's really famous. And so, John, why don't you unpack a little bit of what does that mean? what does that actually mean? How familiar were you with McLuhan prior to this, or was this? I think I vaguely remember you saying this was your first intro to him.
Yeah, no, that's a good call. Unpacking that particular verse's application is going to require a lot of digging beforehand. But yeah, no, I'm not super familiar with McLuhan. I read Neil Postman in college, and he, I think, was kind of downstream from McLuhan's thinking. Mm-hmm. Postman sort of brought a lot of the ideas using vocabulary that people could actually understand. McLuhan is very, very oblique and uses a lot of very literary idioms. So it's a difficult book to break into and read. So summarizing, I'm sure we're going to get lots of things wrong and even completely contradictory to what he intended when we summarize things.
Well, wait a second. I'm not quite so pessimistic here.
Define cold media. Define cold media. All right. No, it'll be a lively conversation for sure. And I'm really interested to dig into it. But yeah, McLuhan is hugely influential. Not a lot of people know about him anymore, but he wrote this book in 1964. And I enjoyed the foreword, which was written in 1994, kind of 30 years right between us and McLuhan. And he was really influential. People spent millions of dollars on ad campaigns based on his theories, but no one really understood what he was talking about. So he's been like misunderstood, misapprehended, but hugely influential for helping us understand the world. And yet, I don't think people have internalized what he's talking about very well. I certainly have it. It's a really foreign way of thinking.
Correct. Yeah. The other thing I'll say is that the good news is that even if we don't comprehend, and you get to the end of this and you're a McLuhan expert and you're like, well, I totally disagree. I think you guys are morons and you guys missed out. We have good news for you, because we just confirmed yesterday that for the third podcast, we're going to do two on the book itself, and then the following week, so it'll be, it doesn't matter the date because it won't correspond with when you guys actually receive it. We're having Marshall McLuhan's son on the podcast, Andrew McLuhan. So that'll be interesting. He responded right back when I shot him a DM on Twitter. We need to get him on Nostra. So he was really excited about the prospect of coming on. So that'll be something to look forward to.
And actually Andrew is, I think, the grandson of Marshall.
Yes. I'm sorry. You're correct. I did the same thing initially and then it like cemented it in my head. So yes, grandson. He's also in charge of the McLuhan Institute. So if you, want to look them up online, you can go find them.
Yeah. So we finally arrived as a podcast.
That's right. We're a pretty big deal right now. the guy who nobody internalized, we have his grandson to come and set it straight.
So with all that hemming and hawing, shall we try to get into the subject matter?
So I
thought an interesting way to get this started would be to just kind of summarize the main parts of McLuhan's argument. He's kind of all over the place. It's a very nonlinear book, which is fitting for the subject matter. Let me just see if I can spitball and explain sort of the high level. You know, the main thing is that he's talking about how media shapes us independent of the content of the media. So, you know, just by virtue of reading a book versus listening to the radio versus, you know, reading from stone tablets or being on the telephone, those are all things that shape us as people and shape society as a collective of people. And these media shape us independent of the content and even contradictory to it often. So he uses the example of the electric light bulb as a media with no content. And I think that's a really helpful example because you can see the effect of the electric light. Other media are less obvious, but you know, the electric light he talks about in his chapter on buildings and on houses, that electric light creates spaces without walls. So, you know, street lamps make it possible to walk outside at night. You know, porch lights extend the domain of your house. And so you're actually dealing with a fairly tangible rearrangement of reality and how we perceive it, how we can use it. And I also think another way that's another medium that is helpful for understanding what he's talking about is architecture. So like light is actually a type of architecture, and architecture is this space that's around us. He's credited with saying we shape our tools and our tools shape us, which is a quote that both of us mentioned at the Thank God for Bitcoin conference a couple weeks ago. And I think that comes from Winston Churchill originally.
I was going to say,
we shape our buildings, and our buildings shape us. But McLuhan also popularized that. So there's a lot more to his argument, but I think that's kind of just like, that's the intro.
Yeah, it's also important because we've used the word, you know, medium. The medium is the message. Then we use the word media. It's just to clarify, he's not talking about media as in like media outlets or something like that. He's talking about extensions of man. So these can be anything made by humans to help them, any kind of a tool. You know, basically tools. They speak about the world and declare that the world works a certain way. Light would be one of these examples. I would love to hear McLuhan talk about, I don't know if you heard this, there's this new company, a startup, that basically is going to have satellite-enabled light. So, like, you can pay them, and they will beam down light to, like, a specific area of the world. And so you're going to be able to have light on demand, like sunlight on demand. And so I think it's actually a really helpful way to kind of illustrate what he's talking about. So he's basically saying, like, if you, a human, can choose to have sunlight at any point that you're, any time you want to, what is that fundamentally saying about you as a human? It's fundamentally saying, like, you're pretty much a god, you know, in the ancient conception of what that means. And so a lot of these things, this idea has incredibly theological and like religious implications, you know, because again, like shaping of reality is, you know, has theological implications about, you know, the way that the world actually is, the way that it works and the way that it ought to work.
Yeah, and he's definitely a product of his time. Like he gets a lot into sort of the psychology of technology and media. And I actually really appreciate that about him. He brings in ideas from evolution and psychology, but without evolutionizing or psychologizing things.
Yes.
He's coming from a very literary perspective. Like he cites James Joyce more often than anyone else.
Yeah.
You know, he talks about how These extensions of man not only allow us to do different things in the world, but they also affect us and and our individual as well as our collective psychology is changed. And so, you know, we have, if we become literate, you know, houses suddenly change from circular into square, because we have entered into this linear type of thinking. And now we begin to see things that we had not seen before. You know, he talks about, you know, indigenous people who don't have systems of counting. They have one, two, three, maybe four, and then heap is the concept.
Yeah.
But the thing about the really strange thing is if you have nine things set up and you remove two, they won't notice. But if you have nine things set up and you remove one, they'll see. So, like, because of our outlook on the world and what the media that we use does to shape us, we start to see or unsee different things depending.
Yeah. Yeah, this is a really, really important point, right? Because, like, we just take for granted that we see the world the way that it is. Like, the way that we see things and understand things is just obvious. Like, well, of course this is how the world is. And that's just not... Like, all of us, we see the world, we have the world mediated to us through, you know, through, there's obviously, there's physical things through which, you know, like, we see them through our eyes, we touch things. But then also, the same thing is true of, like, ideologies and, like, philosophies. We have philosophies that help us, you know, process and, you know, make sense and structure the world. But because those things are unseen, it's easy to discount that process is even happening. So again, he has not gotten into, you know, at least, I mean, I don't know, at least exhaustively into, like, the idea of, like, philosophies. He's talking about this from a standpoint of more, like, physical things, you know, and seeing that. The person who he reminded me a lot of was another JJ. You know, and that would be James Jordan.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, me too. Absolutely.
There's a ton of James B. Jordan overlap for those of you guys who have read him. Just like a lot of the same kind of logic, which I've really, you know, come to appreciate and imitate in a lot of ways.
It was the same sort of experience I had when I was reading James Jordan recently, because like the effect on me was that, okay, here's this framework. It's completely foreign to me. It seems made up. And then it explains so many things.
Yes.
And, you know, I have to be careful to be critical of McLuhan.
Correct.
Because some of the things he says are so outlandish that it's easy to just adopt the frame and be like, of course, that explains everything. But
yes.
Still, it's a really explanatory framework that he has.
And there's definitely things that are more plausible than others. But, yeah, I mean, again, the thing that, this is me, the product of a postmodern, you know, age where, you know, like, certainty about anything, like, we're kind of, like, dubious of whether we can be certain about anything. Like, just the confidence that he has in, like, saying, like, dogmatically some of the things that he says, you're just impressed by the confidence. You're just like, wow, man, this guy's really going for this out of here.
Yeah. He's very certain about his ideas, and he has a very clear picture of them in his head, and everyone else, you know, they're reading his stuff and like, what are you talking about, man? That's completely crazy, which is the reaction people give to James Jordan as well if they haven't been initiated into, like, biblical typology and symbolism.
Yes, exactly.
It's cool that the world works that way, right? Like, it would be easy to come to the Bible as a piece of literary work and say, okay, there's typology and symbolism, and it's limited to the Bible. But that symbolism actually is explanatory in the real world. It leaks outside of the Bible. And he's tapping into a whole different set of symbols and metaphors, but they have explanatory power in the real world.
Yeah. When he just talks about, like, language, I mean, we're going to get into this, but, like, you know, talking about language, like, all language is metaphor. And that's good. Like, we're not used to, you know, we're not used to thinking about that. We're used to thinking much more numerically and scientifically and, you know, having, because of the different technology we have that allows us to, you know, access certain types of precision. You know, we, you know, live in a world where we prioritize those things. And he just basically wants to, you know, rain all over those parades and basically help us to see the limitations of some of those things. So I don't know, John, how do we didn't really go over this beforehand. Do we just want to start going chapter by chapter, or what are your thoughts here in terms of?
I mean, maybe we could do that. it is. There is one other thing I want to touch on before we start doing that is the concept of hot and cold media. I think this is really important to understand. Unfortunately, I don't know if I understand it. I could try to explain it, but
yeah, go
do you have a better grasp of it, maybe?
I'll let you start, and then if I feel like you're... Yeah.
Okay, cool. So he's got this idea of hot and cold media. And hot media is something that is... I'm like already at the end of my... Okay, so cold media is more participatory. Cold media invites the person who is consuming the media into a new way of living, whereas hot media, I think, is more detached, where it's like, here's this thing that you're observing, and it's sort of an assault on your nervous system. So I think he says that movies are hot and TV is cold. And, you know, you kind of have to like dismiss all of your sort of what you feel about those terms, the connotations that those terms give you, because he means something completely different. But, you know, a movie, when you watch a movie, it's this like sensory experience, and it's highly visual because it's telling a story. Even if it's loud, it's using sound in a visual way, in a linear, it's bringing through this linear process to make a point, to elucidate a plot. Whereas TV, you know, regardless of what the actual programs are that are playing on the TV, TV is this sort of thing that people tend to turn on in order to relax, or they have it on in the background, or, you know, they might be playing it at a restaurant or something like that. And it's this thing that actually reshapes the space around you rather than assaulting you frontally with a whole bunch of information. It's kind of like, it's more of an auditory thing, and it's there in the background, it's there in the context, but it reshapes your rituals of what you do in the morning, what you do in the evening, and all that kind of thing. How closely did I get it to your understanding? Because it's possible I got that completely backwards.
I was like struggling with the same thing. So I'm basically, this is okay. So the difference between it would be hot media engages one sense completely. So like you're totally focused on this thing. It doesn't demand interaction. Like you're just kind of, the temptation is for you just to receive. Okay. So the content is like spoon fed to you. So this is a movie. Like this is the temptation with the movie is like you're just drinking down the perspective and things that the director is giving you. This is the temptation. Again, we, as somebody who's a thoughtful person or tries to be a thoughtful person, like we want to actually be far more active. We want to not fall into this trap of what the natural bent of some of these things. But that's how McLuhan would describe something like television or film. They primarily rely on auditory or visual senses. So cold media would require much more participation, much more active attention. So something you put it, imagine like a jigsaw puzzle. Like this requires visual spatial reasoning. This requires a lot more effort, attention, lots of these things. It involves more of you. It requires more of you, as opposed to just giving you stuff. He makes the case that these two things, these two different types of mediums, basically they subsidize and shape, how you become accustomed to responding in other aspects of life. I don't think he, it's not like it's, well, I'm sure he would be more critical of one or the other, but there doesn't seem to be like an evaluation. Well, there's always an evaluation, but there doesn't seem to be like, he's not like TV good, or like, like cold good, the other one bad. Like I'm not seeing, that necessarily. I think he would say that there's a place for both. But they're just basically powerful. He's just trying to help us to, reckon with the fact that these two things exist. We live in a world where these different things exist and we need to be aware of it.
Yeah, he doesn't make a lot of moral judgments, which I appreciate. He's just trying to explain this framework for understanding the world. Mm-hmm. There's a helpful quote that might, that would serve as an example of this paradigm. He says, the principle that distinguishes hot and cold media is perfectly embodied in the folk wisdom, men seldom make passes at girls who wear glasses. Glasses intensify the outward going vision and fill in the feminine image exceedingly, Marion the librarian notwithstanding. Dark glasses, on the other hand, create the inscrutable and inaccessible image that invites a great deal of participation and completion. So when you put on glasses to help you see, it's this extension of you that makes you more intense and more intimidating because you are able to see the other person more clearly. It also focuses your image around your eyes. But then dark glasses hides your eyes and accentuates all of your other features, like, your physical features. And so dark glasses are mysterious and inviting. So dark glasses are a cool medium and regular glasses are a hot medium.
Yeah.
He's wild.
Like it's a wild way of thinking. We're going to get into all kinds of stuff. I can't remember if he gets into hair. I know we're going to talk about clothes and like some of this stuff is just going to seem super batty, but I really think there's value in what he's saying. Like, and he's like, basically everything is communicating. Everything that is in our life is actively working, like it's working to shape us and mold us. I think that's the thing, the underlying thing that we can say. And he's trying to help us. He's trying to give an account for how that is happening, why that's happening, and just to help us be aware of it.
And to kind of like bring it back to the verse we quoted at the beginning, that's something that he cites as an example of how these media. They take over our lives, not completely, but they become these contexts which we can't operate independent of. And so to a certain extent, we people then are changed in order to orient themselves towards the perpetuation of this way of life that they have internalized. So he says any invention or technology is an extension or self-amputation of our physical bodies. And I think that's so key. Once you start using a tool to do something, you forget how to do it without the tool. Mm-hmm. We see this when moving from one tool to another, but we also, our bodies, our actual like physical bodies atrophy as we learn to do, to use tools to do new things. And so extension is also self-amputation. It displaces the older ways of doing things. And so
if you don't use it, you lose it. Like it's one of those kind of things where this is true of your mind. You know, this is true of muscles. If you don't use them, then they go away. And so, again, if you're not using them because you found, for example, this is the age old thing. Your teacher, telling you need to learn how to do these mathematical functions because you're not going to walk around with a calculator in your pocket. Then you're like, well, I'm so sorry, teacher, that you didn't see the advent of the cell phone coming. The smartphone coming, but still, it just, when these things, if we're without our phones or if we're without these things, we're without these awesome tool arsenals that we have, we can just be idiots.
Yeah.
Relative to how previous generations lived.
And so this dependence creates servitude. We Correct. Become the servants of our technology. Our devices become our actual gods. The way he puts this is, he says, by continuously embracing technologies, we relate ourselves to them as servo mechanisms. That is why we must, to use them at all, serve these objects, these extensions of ourselves, as gods or minor religions. An Indian is the servo mechanism of his canoe, as the cowboy of his horse, or the executive of his clock.
Yeah.
Yeah. And this, man, this is, if you think about it, you're like, what in the world is he talking about? Like, one of the things that I just think about is, I mean, there's been times where I've spent literal days trying to, get my, my Apple devices or whatever, my devices to work together. I'm having some sort of issue getting them to sync. Because one thing is broken and all of my things normally work together, I'm unable to do the things that I need to do because of this, And so it's like I've built my life, or at least a part of my life, onto, Apple world. And so now I'm dependent on them. I have a contingency now. It's part of my life. And so if they have a problem, now I have a problem. And so, this is how all of us have these things. All of these things, you know, operate, and all of us have more foundational things that are below, you know, Apple world. Like, we have these different pre-commitments, our understanding of, you know, and there's things that we're ultimately serving. All of us have them, even if we don't recognize or acknowledge it, like, they're still there. But they do affect us, to McLuhan and your point, Jen.
Yeah, and this extends even beyond physical things to social things and conventions and stuff mm-hmm. like that, which are themselves kinds of technology. Like, just like you have to take care of your Apple devices or maintain your house, you know, our social context demands that you don't smell bad. And so therefore you spend time on personal hygiene. Or, you know, our social context requires that we be literate. And so we spend a whole lot of time learning how to read and how to write. These are all tasks that are necessary for us to survive within the technological framework. And technological meaning not just device oriented, but also, you know, conventional framework. You know, hygiene is its own technology. It's not like it's, you know, this thing that someone invented, but it is a useful tool and convention and way of interacting with other people that has certain trade-offs. I can't think of what the downsides of hygiene might be, but I'm sure there are some.
Well, though, I'll give you an example of this. Like, one of the downsides is just the time that it requires to, you know, again, if you're talking about your personal hygiene, I mean, that requires, you know, if you're going to, it requires a certain amount of time every day to do that. And depending how dirty you get, again, this is more humorous when you're thinking about your average person, you know, just through their normal life, taking a shower. But like, if you think about somebody who's like a mechanic or somebody, like if you work in an oil well and you know, you come out every day and, you know, you're covered head to toe in oil or something, and like you have to take like your process, it's going to be an hour long process for you to get clean. And so, you know, 1/24th of your day, at least, or, you know, as an example, is going to be used to doing that. And so you have to make time to do that. And so like that's one of these things where it at the very least has a time component. Another thing
there is that. Yeah, but to go on with the hygiene thing, yeah. He actually does talk about this a little bit in his chapter on clothing. Mm-hmm. When we are hygienic, we're actually reducing how much our bodies smell, and that reduces Correct. The amount of communication that we do through smell. Not because like we smell a particular way. It's just like it changes again the social interaction that we have with other people.
Yep.
And there are cultures that rely more on smell and on like physical senses than on visual and auditory, because those are emphasized very heavily in our Western literate culture. There's a quote on page 122. He says, "To a person using the whole sensorium, nudity is the richest possible expression of structural form. But to the highly visual and lopsided sensibility of industrial societies, the sudden confrontation with tactile flesh is heady music indeed." And this is why indigenous societies just walk around naked like it's no big deal, because that's the milieu that they live in. That's the medium that shapes their lives.
And then, I mean, you could also tie to this idea of hygiene, like disease. Like, that's another thing is like, you know, there's a cost there associated that, you know, a lot of primitive peoples don't recognize. Like, they don't necessarily recognize the relationship between those two things. And so, in any event, the point is that it's shaping the different ways that we interact with each other.
We become servants of our media. This is another like famous quote of his, man becomes, as it were, the sex organs of the machine world. Machines can't procreate without people being shaped by the machines and becoming reliant on them.
I underlined that one. That was
I underlined everything. One interesting quote is, he says, because of its action in extending our central nervous system, electric technology seems to favor the inclusive and participational spoken word over the specialist written word. And this is just a preview of a lot of stuff that he later talks about in the book, as far as, you know, we moved from a spoken word sort of society generally into a, starting with the Greeks, into a Western linear written society. And he sees the electronic age as moving back into the spoken word, which I think there's a lot to that.
Yep. Yeah, this is, I mean, the famous illustration of this, right, is the first televised presidential debate. You know, this is between Nixon and JFK. And basically going into the debate, Nixon, like, had it in the bag, looked like he was going to win. And then, you know, as people saw the contrast of this old man, old wrinkled, you know, man Nixon, and this young, ridiculously good-looking JFK, it basically superseded argument, and he ended up winning the, you know, winning the election. And so this is, you know, very much like the TV and the visual medium that it does, you know, it's kind of, like post-literate, like you're bypassing rational argument and moving strictly to visual things.
I think that's really, really telling, bypassing rational argument, because we do see an increase in that kind of thing, you know, like cancel culture kind of comes to mind, but it's broader than that. There's no time to establish rational arguments. We're in this time of really a lot of churn in terms of what everyone's thinking about and talking about. There's no time to actually figure out the truth of any given issue and litigate it, because that takes a lot of time and it's a linear thing. But, you know, he talks about how a linear view of the world establishes cause and effect by antecedent precedent. I think he says David Hume proved that that wasn't necessarily the case, and that cause and effect can be kind of simultaneous temporally. Mm-hmm. He also talks about the contraction and expansion of time. You know, pre-literate societies didn't even have a concept of time. Everything had its own timeline. It takes a certain amount of time to milk the cow, a certain amount of time for the crops to mature. And so time was attached to an activity, whereas starting with monks in the Middle Ages, time, I'm jumping way ahead here, there's the whole chapter on time, but the monks would mark time in order to keep their kind of rigorous schedule of study and prayer and fasting and all that kind of thing. And that actually fragmented reality into tiny little chunks and created this linearity that fits really well with the written word. And now, you know, you see the videos of like toddlers with on their iPad with like a TikTok video on the left and a game on the right. Yeah. And they're doing all this stuff and drinking their chocolate milk at the same time and whatever. And we have entered this age of simultaneity where multiprocessing is the default, both in our own minds and in our own lives, but also, you know, in terms of machines. Are becoming less and less linear, you know, with old mainframes, you could only run one job at a time. You'd have to wait for the other guy to finish his thing so that your program could run. But now we have multiple cores on all our computers, and then those cores all exist on servers, and they're all partitioned out. We've got Lambda functions that just run for a split second. There's all this like coordination and simultaneity now.
Yeah, which again, you know, sounds great, right? And it sounds like, oh man, why would that be a problem? Well, like, I mean, the problem is there's 84 things going on at any one time now that you have the expectation of being able to be, you know, like for instance, we have the illusion of being able to be accessible at all times. You know, like there's times where I've texted you, John, like I just reflexively go to text you and then realize, oops, it's like 10:30 at night, and I'm like, feel free to ignore this till tomorrow, you know, but just like the fact that I can send John a message, you know, using a medium that doesn't tell me, oh, look at what time it is. Like there's no limitation of time. Whereas, you know, like if previously, you know, before we had these kind of, you know, mechanisms, I would, you know, let's say I'd walk outside. I'm like, oh, I gotta go walk down to John's house and go tell him something. And I would look outside and I'm like, oh, it's already dark. You know, I'll just wait till tomorrow. You know, we'd have these other things to help us. But the like electricity, which is one of his big things, is like electricity has enabled humanity to bypass a lot of these, you know, from a Christian perspective, like designed limitations. It's enabled us to overcome a lot of them with mixed effect.
Yeah, it's contracted time, so there, so time no longer exists in certain ways. I also think an interesting way to think about this is the concept of revealed preference. This isn't from McLuhan; it's a term I learned a while ago, but it's the idea that whatever someone says their values are, their revealed preference is the truth. So what they do speaks louder than what they say. And, you know, for example, I like to sit in the backyard and listen to the wind blowing through the trees, but I don't actually do it that often. I usually am listening to a podcast instead. So what is my revealed preference? Like, what am I actually valuing more or less? And the evolution of those preferences is partly human agency, but it's also partly the media that are invented in them and then change us. One of my favorite parts of the book, this is not like necessarily super important in pushing things forward, but I just wanted to read the story of Tzu Gung. Do you remember that one?
Yep. Yeah. Go for it.
So as Tzu Gung was traveling through the regions north of the River Han, he saw an old man working in his vegetable garden. He had dug an irrigation ditch. The man would descend into a well, fetch up a vessel of water in his arms, and pour it out into the ditch. While his efforts were tremendous, the results appeared to be very meager. Tzu Gung said, "There is a way whereby you can irrigate 100 ditches in one day, and whereby you can do much with little effort. Would you not like to hear of it?" Then the gardener stood up, looked at him, and said, "And what would that be?" Tzu Gung replied, "You take a wooden lever, weighted at the back and light in the front. In this way, you can bring up water so quickly that it just gushes out. This is called a draw well." Then anger rose up in the old man's face, and he said, "I have heard my teacher say that whoever uses machines does all his work like machines. He who does his work like a machine grows a heart like a machine, and he who carries the heart of a machine in his breast loses his simplicity. He who has lost his simplicity becomes unsure in the strivings of his soul. Uncertainty in the strivings of the soul is something which does not agree with honest sense. It is not that I do not know of such things. I am ashamed to use them."
Mm.
I like the focus on simplicity there, where by introducing all this complexity into our lives, we become more complex people, and we actually escape our own ability to know ourselves.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the things that made me think about immediately is, you know, Jesus saying, like, unless you become like a child, like there is a sense in which, you know, like simplicity, like there's a sense in which we should be simple people, you know, who live in simple dependence. And so not all, you know, progress is actually progress. Like there's plenty of progress that's regressive, you know, that tears away at, you know, at what we are. But again, like, I think to the broader point, like, you know, there's nothing that's just neutral. Like all this stuff is, you know, whatever it is, whether it's an idea, whether it's a, you know, tool, whatever it is, like it's pointing us towards, it's basically preaching. It's preaching, and it comes from somewhere. It comes from an understanding of reality, an understanding of what is good and true and desirable. And we have to be constantly, just like the, you know, just like it's not easy to do with something like movies, we have to be testing, you know, we ought to be suspicious of and test these narratives that we're, you know, being presented with, because there's, you know, a lot of times these things are propaganda. Like this is, you know, this could, again, this could go from like a philosophical level. This could be, you know, from a product level, we're more quick to recognize it. But just even politically, like so much of the, you know, there's things that are communicated non-verbally. You know, like I was thinking there's this guy, comedian, who went to the Democratic National Convention, and he's actually conservative, but he like pretended to be like this effeminate guy, and he just starts going, "Did you see this?"
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, it's so great. But he walks around and he starts interviewing people, and he's like using all of these basically like Taylor Swift born you know, like lingo. And so he's like, cool. "Kamala, it's such a vibe," you know, and like he's so like, in talking about like a vibe, like this is literally, it's talking about like this is intuition. Like he's talking about, you know, this is nonverbal, like this goes beyond words, you know, being here, it's such a vibe, you know. And so I just was like, this is my nightmare. this is truly terrifying. You know, like if you were to ask someone, like, what does it mean? I think somebody actually did even ask him, like, what does that mean? And he's like, well, you know, it's just a vibe. And it's just you've moved beyond the written word, and now it's completely based on, you know, a subjective, sensorial, experience of being at a place at a time, of, you know, how everyone is feeling about being there. And they've, and this is, again, they didn't say this. It just made me think of the meme from, The Big Short. Why are they confessing? And, you know, like they talk to these guys who have been scamming people, selling homes to hookers, basically, who shouldn't ever be able to get these amount of houses that they're getting. And so they're sitting there telling them what they're doing, telling them how they're making tons of money. They've got boats and cars and all these things. And so the financial people, they can kind of go over by themselves. They're like, all right, we need to talk about this. And so the one says the other, why are they confessing? Like, they're confessing to fraud and all these things. And so the guy says, they're not confessing, they're bragging.
Yeah.
And so I think, like, that's a big part of this is somebody was talking about the convention. They said that there wasn't really a lot of discussion about the ideas. And, you know, they're like, you know, the average voter they're not interested in ideas. They want to know that, you know, someone's at the helm who cares about them, you know? And so it's very much about this intuitional, you know, nonverbal, non-ideological, you know, understanding of what politics ought to be and who one ought to vote for. And so this is, again, completely at odds with, you know, the foundation that built, Western civilization. You know, like we have been a people of the word, a people of the book. And again, to McLuhan's point, which, I mean, you got to remember, he's writing these things, I mean, 80 years ago, 75, 80 years ago. Like, he would be rolling in his grave if he could see some of these things today.
It sounds like you're making a value judgment there, Jordan. Like, Western culture is better than other cultures.
I in many ways it is, and there's very many other ways in which I'm happy to confess that it is not. But again, you have to be able to. We have to be able to. I know you're just joking, but like, this is one of these things where, like, you have to be able to say this. Like, you have to be able to say, and, you know, objectively, like, this is a better situation. Again, it is important, though, that, you know, no one culture, like, fully encapsulates, you know, truth and fully encapsulates faithfulness to, you know, what it means to be human. And the temptation is always to you know, look down on and judge those just by virtue of them being different. But I do think, you know, it is important to be able to critique both others and yourself.
Yeah, the term that comes to mind is resourcement, right? Yeah. This is what Protestants do, Reformed Protestants do. They look at the history of the church. There's 1,500 years of the Catholic Church, and there's only 500 years of the Protestant Church. And that doesn't mean that, you know, the Protestant Church is illegitimate because there's this gap. It's actually like we have a lot in common with the earlier church, even more in common with the earlier church in some ways than the Catholic Church nowadays does. So, you know, we had to make a pretty strong break from the Catholic Church in the beginning, and that kind of sent a lot of parts of the Protestant Church off the rails. But now, you know, we get to come back and sort of retrieve a lot of those things that made the Catholic tradition really rich and actually belong to Protestants as well.
Yeah, and this is something that, again, like, a lot of Protestants, they want to do like a complete, like a cut from the Catholic Church. Like, the church started in 1500, you know, like 1592. Like, you know, this is, you know, when the real, it's just like, good Lord, my word. Like, I mean, just Luther himself, probably the biggest critic of the Roman Catholic Church that, you know, is out there, was one of the first to say that there were tons of, you know, Roman Catholic priests in his day who were faithful priests, who, you know, there were true churches within these things. So just, yeah, this, you know, Protestant trope that, you know, things really didn't get started faithfully until 1500 is just bonkers.
Yeah, it's interesting to see the environment, just to go on this tangent a little longer, that God placed Jesus into. You know, Jesus was born in the Middle East, right between the ancient world and the classical world.
Correct.
And he spoke Greek, but he also spoke Hebrew. Hebrew is a very simultaneous, inference-heavy language. It's full of symbolism. It has a small vocabulary, so there's a lot of overlap in what words mean, whereas Greek is a lot more precise. It was the the language of scholars and professional people. And Jesus is right there in the middle of it. We even have two versions of the Old Testament, one in Hebrew and one in Greek.
Yeah.
And, you know, this center of the world sort of phenomenon that Jerusalem had is key in helping us to gather the best parts of the ancient world into the Christian tradition. I don't know. I just find it so interesting that that's where Christianity began, but then also that we have the Western take on things has been the one that has filled the world rather than the Eastern approach.
Yeah. Well, and this is how the scriptures describe that time when Jesus comes as the fullness of time. Like in the fullness of time, God sent his son, like God sent Jesus. He shows up, you know, he both lives, teaches, and embodies. Like in Jesus, this is another example, right? Like it's really important that it's not just Jesus' teaching that is important. It's his teaching and his life. It's both the, you know, the daily walking, which is more, you know, more Eastern, and then it's also his teaching. Like his you know, dialectic is important as well. And then obviously the Christian scriptures have been the foundation for Western civilization. You know, a lot of our law tradition is built off of, you know, both the Ten Commandments and then, you know, things are, so again, I guess that's more Eastern. But again, you've got a lot of these things where, you know, like Jesus is kind of like, he is this translator, this medium moving from one age into another. And yeah, it's really fascinating. I have a number of things underlined, you know, about, you know, Jesus as this medium. And actually, I'll read this quote. I sent it to you. Let me see if I can find this real quick. I was reading. I can't remember. I knew that. I found out that McLuhan was Catholic. And so I just was like, oh, I wonder what else he said about, you know, about Jesus or just about religion. And so I found this quote and sent it to you. Again, I think it was like 11:30 at night. I'll see if I can find it. 11:35 p.m. I overcame and ignored my human limitations and, you know, leveraged these tools for my own glory. And so here's the quote. It says, in Jesus Christ, there is no distance or separation between the medium and the message. It is the one case where we can say that the medium and the message are fully one and the same.
That's awesome.
I just thought, I was like, man, that is one of the most base things I've ever heard in my life.
Yeah,
I was like,
absolutely.
So good, you know, and like Jesus being called the light of the world.
And, you know, the Logos.
Yeah, the Logos, exactly. Yeah, all of these things. Like, it's just really profound. I mean, super profound. And to see, you know, McLuhan, this super thoughtful guy, kind of recognizing that was, you know, was fun.
And approaching biblical or church history from this sort of media angle changes the question from what should we believe to what kind of people should we be. And, you know, because that was a lot of what divided the early church was, like, you know, are you a monophysite? That's like the worst thing you can be. And it's this really thin distinction about the nature of Christ that split the entire Roman Empire apart into East and West. And that was like what people really cared about was these propositional sort of things, even at that time. But it results in two halves of the church and two halves of humanity that are very different in terms of like their spiritual lives. And so, you know, what kind of people should we be is a much deeper question than just what should we believe. But I you know, of course, the two are related.
Yes. No, definitely. The other thing that this, again, the medium being the message. So if Christ is the one place where, you know, the medium is the message, it just made me think about like humanity. If you think of like, a lot of these questions are grounded upon an understanding of what it means to be human. Like everything that we're doing, like the reason why you're doing it, you're doing it based on these, you know, pre-existing beliefs that you have about the nature of reality and people and all these things. And so it was impactful for me to think about, like, you know, God made people. So God, like, people are this medium that God created to serve a purpose. Like he has, you know, something that he wants them to accomplish. And so God makes man. Okay. He does that. And then he gives them work to do. He gives them, you know, a telos to, you know, work towards and, you know, live towards. And then in the fullness of time, this, you know, God takes on human flesh. Like this is Jesus. So the creator takes on flesh. And so, you know, the message, you know, becomes the medium, becomes the message, you know, and this is the thing. So, and then Jesus is sitting there, he's coming. And what is his goal? Like, you know, he's sitting there, you know, his goal is to get humanity to trust God again and to walk with him. And so, you know, somebody asked this group of people asked Jesus, you know, well, what must I be doing to be doing the works of God? And Jesus answers them, well, believe in the one who he sent. And so you have this weird, you know, like this really interesting mix of like, what is the work that we're supposed to be doing here? And Jesus goes, well, the work is believing. And so it's this mixture again of the doing and mixture of like active and passive. And it's this mixture of all these things. Jesus is just this mysterious figure who, you know, has come to basically shatter all your conceptions about what is about who you are and about what you're doing and why it matters and, you know, all these different things.
Yeah. And in his case, he is a medium in the sense that he's an extension of God, not primarily of man, but he's also an extension of man because he's man himself. He bridges the gap. And, you know, the effect that McLuhan says that media has is that of changing us and making us servants. And so if there is this perfect medium that encompasses both God and man, we, of course, it's going to be the medium that wins out and to which we become servants ultimately, not necessarily even because we say that we want to do that, but because it changes us. And so the whole world, all these other media are being changed by the one medium, Jesus. You know, like one of my favorite verses is the world will be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. Mm. And I like that so much because that's not just filling a bucket all the way full, right? The waters are the sea. It's an identification. So God is actually changing the world to literally be the knowledge of the Lord. And that doesn't make a lot of sense because, you know, gravel has no ability to affirm a proposition. But gravel does have the ability to be placed in the right way so that it glorifies God and benefits man. And so, you know, the subduing of the world is its glorification. And that glorification looks like everything being in the right place for God's glory and for the good of man.
Right, wholesome, and beneficial.
All right, should we bring it else? Back to our survey? We're still in the written word here. I did want to pick up on what he says about the phonetic alphabet versus pictographs. He says that, the phonetically written word sacrifices worlds of meaning and perception that were secured by forms like the hieroglyph and the Chinese ideogram. These culturally richer forms of writing, however, offered men no means of sudden transfer from the magically discontinuous and traditional world of the tribal world into the cool and uniform visual medium. So, you know, despite pictograms being richer in meaning, it allowed more inferential simultaneous man to remain in that state and have written language. And the phonetic alphabet sliced everything up. He says, the phonetic alphabet makes such a sharp division in experience, giving to its user an eye for an ear and freeing him from the tribal trance of resonating word magic and the web of kinship. And that's the advance that actually pushed things forward, was the phonetic alphabet, not just the alphabet.
Yeah.
Or rather, the written word.
Yeah. It makes me think of, so I'm back in the, this chapter in part one, chapter five, Hybrid Energy. He talks about the difference between fragmented man. So he said, for the fragmented man creates the homogenized Western world, while oral societies are made up of people differentiated not by their specialist skills or visible marks, but by their unique emotional mixes. The oral man's inner world is a tangle of complex emotions and feelings that the Western practical man has long ago eroded or suppressed within himself in the interest of efficiency and practicality. And so, like, that really is, like, he's just basically saying, like, different people around the world at different, you know, whether they're, you know, whether they're oral or, literary or oral, like, they have different, again, this isn't even saying who's right. This is just descriptively saying they see the world very differently. And it affects, it's going to affect how they see the world, how they interact with it. It's also going to affect what happens when these, when people with these different types of worldviews interact. And so, like, again, there's, we don't have to get into this, but I couldn't help thinking about, like, there's a lot of, you know, a lot of the implications of this are profound as it relates to something like immigration, where you have oral peoples, you know, coming into contact with, you know, more, you know, written culture peoples. Like, it's, you're going to have, at the very least, it's going to be, there's going to be conflict there because there's such foundational, fundamental differences in what things look like and how they see and experience and understand the world.
Yeah,
that could be, yeah. I mean, that could be, we could talk about, I mean, I have like a number of things that are where that, you know, a number of passages where that came to mind and, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think that is like, that is a huge theme within the book. We also, you know, we talked about the elimination of time earlier. He also talks about the elimination of space. He says, all means of interchange and of human interassociation tend to improve by acceleration. Speed, in turn, accentuates problems of form and structure. You know, so a person who takes an airplane, the airplane is this, like, place of stasis where you're not actually traveling anymore. The yeah. time when you're moving fastest is when the time when you have the least amount of experience yeah. of traveling. When you exit the airplane, that's when you actually begin traveling. When you yeah. sit down at the cafe, that's when you're really traveling.
Yeah.
You know, he also talks about, like, a speed up in communications always enables the central authority to extend its operations to more distant margins. So, you know, you've got the road in ancient Rome and the telegraph more recently. And that created the ability for authorities and governments to reach across the world in ways that they would not have been able to do otherwise.
Do you remember, and like he talks about how like trade, you know, basically like the, he referred to them as the Mohammedans.
Yeah.
But how, like they kind of at one point shut off Europe to the trade of papyrus, which I can't remember. I'm guessing it's coming from like Egypt. Is that the kind of the case? Like it's coming from the, yeah. So, like, basically, there was
this decline of bureaucracy and an army and of army organization as well. Yeah.
Yeah. So, basically, there's this period where, you know, like, I mean, hundreds of years where they got cut off from papyrus. And so they really didn't have it anymore. And so it was far more scarce. And then, you know, eventually, I can't remember what he calls it. He calls it Gutenberg's discovery or something. Like, it's not even as straightforward as discovery. It's like Gutenberg's some interesting word. Oh, he put it. I can't remember what it was. It just made me laugh. Like until Gutenberg, there was like this hundreds of years period where they just didn't have the ability to, you know, easily and efficiently, you know, write things and then spread that, you know, over a given place. And so he's basically accounting for the Gutenberg printing press. I mean, that had this. It was like this. Spark in a powder keg. It was the right time, the right thing at the right time, resulted in this, you know, giant explosion of effect.
Yeah, and he extrapolates that out to the electric age, where he says that now that man has extended his central nervous system by electric technology, the field of battle has shifted to mental image making and breaking, both in war and in business. He also mentions that war is always accelerated technological change, so it's always a result of one nation getting ahead of the other. And now we're all so close together because of the digital world that those differences in our adaptation to more advanced media become more obvious. And so there's like constant mental warfare going on all the time now.
Well, and the crazy thing too, I mean, and this is what, I mean, so he talks about computers and there's some quote, I can't remember where it is. I'll have to find it. There's this quote about computers. He talks about, like, computers offer the promise of being able to translate any language into any other language, like, very rapidly.
Yeah,
and I'm like,
he's very optimistic.
This dude is writing in the 1950s. It's like, he's sitting there talking, this could have been written, you know, like, yesterday. Like, what he's describing is already, it already exists. The other thing was, like, this guy never saw the internet. Like, obviously, he saw it coming. Like, phrase that, like, I say all the time. Basically, it was like this, you know, idea that came to me, was just like that reason is a time machine. Like, if you can reason correctly, like you can, again, you might as well, and this is somebody like C.S. Lewis, I'm like, are we sure he didn't have an actual time machine? You know, like Chesterton, another one. You're just like, goodness gracious, these guys are, like, they reasoned so well and they saw certain things so clear that it allowed them to extrapolate in ways that were incredibly, incredibly perceptive. And that, you know, we've seen a ton of what they predicted was going to happen actually has come to pass. And yeah. And McLuhan is another one who, you know, definitely falls into that category.
Yeah, and you know, he moves on from the written word into chapter 11, where he talks about numbers, and this was really counterintuitive to me. He says, "Number, you know, you would think that number would be the ultimate linear form, right? Mm. Because it's ultimate quantification. What he says instead is, number is an extension and separation of our most intimate and interrelating activity, our sense of touch.
Yeah.
So, because number is like, more simultaneous and it's alien to the mind of man.
Yep.
It's not logical. It's statistical. And so, yeah, you have more of a feel with numbers than you do with words. Words are like looking at something. Numbers are like feeling it.
Well, and then both of them, I mean, again, as a Christian, like you think about like the emphasis and the emphasis of, or the contrast between seeing and believing, you know, like there's a spiritual emphasis on basically hearing is you know, emphasized as like the height of communication. Like, whoever hears my voice, you know, my sheep hear my voice.
Hmm.
And so like hearing my voice actually is more discernibly true than even seeing somebody. Somebody can, you know, disguise themselves to look a certain way that is false, but it's far more difficult. And even today with like AI, like it's still far more difficult to recreate someone's voice in a way that is, you know, able to be, you know, convincing. And so, yeah, just like you have like the writing, you can see it. Okay. And then you have, what was the other thing he was saying? Like numbers as well. So like there's reading and seeing, I think these two things, they're both heavily visual. They're both heavy emphasis
very
on
linear.
Seeing. Yeah. On seeing rather than hearing. And so I think it's easy for, you know, for us to think we're novel and putting a lot of prioritization. Well, I won't believe something unless I see it, you know? And it's like, well, we're literally just falling back. I mean, this is literally tale as old as time. This is the same standard that the Apostle Thomas had for, you know, not believing. You know, he decided he was going to believe whether or not Jesus had actually risen from the dead. He's like, I won't believe until I see it and I touch him. Like, if I see and touch him, that's sufficient evidence. And, you know, and so then, like, Jesus, you know, basically allows him to do both of those things. And then said, you know, you believe because you saw me. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet believed. And so there's this premium put on, you know, the ability to hear and believe something, the ability to, you know, to hear something and then be forced to reason about its truthfulness and to, you know, follow that to completion. That's totally able to happen. And there seems to be a moral premium put on that type of communication.
Yeah, that's interesting. And with numbers, you know, they're abstract, but they're not concrete. He talks about how Europeans see America as the land of abstractions, where numbers have taken on an existence of their own, in phrases like 57 varieties, the 5 and the 10, or 7 up and behind the 8 ball. It just made me think of Bitcoiners, you know, 21 million, 69, 420, 58K, all these, you know?
Yeah. Okay, here, I found the quote. I want to read this. So this is in chapter 8, on page, I guess, 80. I think I saw we have the same book. So he says, as an extension or outering of our senses at once, language has always been held to be man's richest art form, that which distinguishes him from the animal creation. The first thing that came to mind is and I think we've probably talked about this too, is like the Apostle Paul, like he describes sinful humanity as he did, you know, compares them with unreasoning animals. And so he seems to suggest that, you know, reason is this thing that separates people from animals. It's this distinguishing thing. And so then this is further bolstered by, you know, there's places in the Old Testament where Israel has fallen into sin, and God's solution for them, he says, come, let us reason together. And so he's basically trying to, he's like, be more human. Like, you're acting like animals, like be more human and reason well. And so he then says, he talks about this idea shortly after this. He says, our very word, our new electric technology that extends our senses and nerves in a global embrace has large implications for the future of language. Electric technology does not need words anymore, or any more than the digital computer needs numbers. Like, that's an interesting thing. I'm like, well, like, code is all numbers, so you kind of still did need it. But he said, electricity points the way to an extension of the process of consciousness itself on a world scale and without any verbalization whatsoever. Whatever. Such a state of collective awareness may have been the proverbial condition of men. Language is the technology of human extension, whose powers of division and separation we know so well may have been the Tower of Babel by which man sought to scale the highest heavens. Today, computers hold out the promise of a means of instant translation of any code or language into any other code or language. The computer, in short, promises by technology a Pentecostal condition of universal understanding and unity, which is like kind of what's happened. Like, it's crazy. Like, to, and what we're quickly seeing, though, is like that it's not simply the raw words that are sufficient to bring, you know, this peace and understanding. There's a far more earthy and you know, relational component to this that, you know, is beyond what we would want to believe. But so he says this, that the next logical step would seem to be then not to translate, but to bypass languages in favor of a general cosmic consciousness, which might be very like the collective unconscious dreamt of by Bergson. The condition of quote-unquote weightlessness that biologists say promises a physical immortality may be paralleled by the condition of speechlessness that could confer a perpetuity of collective harmony and peace. And so, again, like, think about what he's saying. So he's basically saying, like, if everyone being able to share one language is ideal, the thing that would be even more ideal is if we could communicate without language. And so initially that sounds weird, right? And yet, if, you know, both of us are married, we've had occasions where something happens and, you know, like, somebody says something and you look at your wife and your wife looks at you and you know, without either of you saying a word, that you're thinking about the exact thing that the other person is thinking about. And so, like, there is truth to this. Like, the height of intimacy, like, goes subverbal or like sublinguistic. To a real degree, it makes me think of the passage where it talks about the Holy Spirit, like, he intercedes for us with groanings that are too deep for words. So, like, there is some thought to this, but like this value of, you know, like, the idea that there's, you know, on the other hand, like, the value that the idea that, like, there's this certain weightlessness, like, he talks about, like, this is this good thing. You know, like, weightlessness, what it made me think of is that, like, you know, a weightlessness is also, there's a sense in which it can contain like a gloriousness is what I'm trying to say. Because, like, basically weight, the idea of glory is this idea of weight. And so, like, there's the idea of, like, it's almost like a little bit Gnostic, almost. Like, we're going to try to get rid of all the physical things and we're just going to be left with, you know, these things that are not, and that'll be the peak. I don't know if that's what he's trying to get across or not.
Yeah, it feels very much like kind of the transhumanist ideal of, yes, reduction of consciousness into what can be represented by machines. But I think he is actually, he's saying something very different, whereas transhumanists would have us put into, you know, uploaded into the computer. He's saying that the computer is the extension of our consciousness, which allows us to speak without words, without giving up our actual humanity. I mean, maybe not, because he does say that extensions are also amputations.
Yeah.
But it's this whole different mode of being. And it's really interesting that he's saying that computers allow for this Pentecostal revival and almost like a perfect language, but it's intermediated by numbers. You know, computers bypass numbers. Numbers are simultaneous and statistical, and computers deal with numbers a lot. But what he says about binary code is that it's yes and no. And, you know, Jesus says, let your yes be yes and your no be no. Yeah. Like, computers are the most decisive, you know, things there are. And that's distilled language, just the binary. Yeah, man, there's a lot in that quote.
Yeah. Yep. I'm trying to think. So the first, I really, this one thing in chapter 9, he's Prince Madupe. I don't know who this is. It's West African days, his encounter with the written word. Basically, these are people encountering the written word for the first time. This is a really interesting thing. The one crowded space in Father Perry's house was his bookshelves. I gradually came to understand that the words on the pages were trapped, or that the marks on the pages were trapped words. Anyone could learn to decipher the symbols and turn the trapped words loose again into speech. The ink of the print trapped the thoughts. They could no more get away than a dumbu could get out of a pit. When the full realization of what this meant flooded over me, I experienced the same thrill and amazement as when I had my first glimpse of the bright lights of Conakry. I have no idea what that is. I shivered with the intensity of my desire to learn to do this wondrous thing myself.
Yeah. It reminds me of the guy who reads the letters that are sent to the people in his tribe, because he's the only literate one there, but okay. He doesn't want to violate their privacy, so he puts his fingers in his ears while he reads out loud the letters.
It's awesome.
It's fantastic. I love seeing the glimpses, those glimpses into different, like a whole way of different way of thinking about things.
Yeah. For some reason, the idea of like marks on the page trapped, you know, were trapped words. For some reason made me think of like Mitch Hedberg. Are you familiar with him? I'm like, sounds like the beginning of a Mitch Hedberg joke or something.
It totally could be. Yeah. He's one of my favorites. Yeah, one thing that like comes to mind also that's later on, I think in the housing chapter, he talks about how Eskimos didn't always live in igloos. Mm. They used to live in stone houses, and they still do. And igloos were made possible because stoves were introduced by trappers, and so the Eskimo became a trapper only after he had made contact with the white man. Up until then, he had been simply a food gatherer. Let the igloo serve as an example of the way in which a new pattern is introduced into an ancient way of life by the intensification of a single factor, in this instance, artificial heat. So, you know, it's really easy, and this is like a pitfall that I fall into. It's easy to kind of generalize and theorize about like these big categories, but McLuhan's great because he really dials it down to specific instances where it's like Eskimos had their whole way of life changed because of a piece of iron that could hold heat and emanate heat, where this one little thing has a really obvious outsized effect. And that's true of everything. Every piece of technology has an effect, but it's usually so tangled together that we can't really discern what those things are.
Do you remember the other thing he talks about in that regard, where it's like the missionaries show up and give the indigenous people, like basically like the height of technology for them was like these iron axes or something, and then these missionary women like show up and give them like these like steel ones, and like overnight like it completely turns this thing upside down, because like there was like some social component, I can't remember, like it like shamed all the men. That like they had these subpar things now. These other ones were so much better, and just he just was basically descriptively saying like this had this transformational in a negative way like impact on these societies just by virtue of dropping this thing that again to the larger point is we would say if you were to try to evaluate is it a good thing or not, like are these iron or steel axes, are these good things or bad things, you'd be like, well, it matters, it's really just about what you do with them that determines whether or not they're good or bad. And it's like, but it's like, no, the medium is the message. There's a whole bunch more ways in which this is going to affect people than just that, simple element.
I had the opportunity to talk to the guy who runs Gridless, I think. He did talk at the for Bitcoin conference. What's his name?
Eric Hirschman.
That's right. Yeah. So I talked to him a little bit.
Shout to Philip, shout to Eric.
If you listen to our podcast,
every episode.
I got to talk to him a little bit, and I was asking the question because in the in his presentation he showed like once we introduce this this economical way to produce energy in Africa, people then have energy that they can use for speeding up their farming tasks, buying a TV, et cetera, et cetera. And it struck me as like is it a good thing that we have given these people TVs? And I don't know if there's a way to put it that doesn't sound patronizing,
yeah,
where it's
yeah.
like, well, maybe we should steward our technology to make sure that these poor people don't get what we enjoy all the time because it might hurt them. But like, there is something to that. These media have changed us, and we recognize this change, and we feel alienated from ourselves. And, you know, there is some romanticism to say, like, well, I wish I didn't have any of it. I would like to just return to nature. But it struck me reading McLuhan, like introducing TV to these like tribal societies could actually be a good thing, because he talks about, like, you know, the phonetic alphabet versus the pictorial alphabet, providing this break from the past that allows people to change. And the TV actually could be a really good way to introduce the very inferential sort of tribal superstitious kind of culture into Western thought without it being like completely jarring and impoverishing. So, you know, like these things should be taken with care, but I think it's like beyond anyone's understanding to really be able to understand what these new cultural imports actually, what the effect they actually
And is. Again, there's some people probably who are going to listen to this and they're going to be like, well, you know, this is just pure colonialism. Like, you're just importing these
ideas. Yeah.
You know, and like, I'll never forget. So I went to Papua New Guinea when I was right before my junior year of college. And it took like three or four planes to get there. And the last plane is this little puddle jumper. And I was with this woman who is an anthropologist. And she was talking about, we were talking about this missionary friend of mine who was in like West Papua, Indonesia. And just basically about how, you know, they miss about their life. And so she like strongly objected to the idea that, you know, there's people coming in there and quote unquote ruining these traditions that had been passed down for thousands of years or whatever. And again, I'm like, okay, I understand, like, there's like the core of what you're saying, but also, like, you have to, like, here's one example. Like, these people are terrified to go into the water because there's like these evil spirits that they're afraid of that are in the water. And so like coming in there and like basically telling them, you know, hey, like, there's like the God who made the world is actually the Lord of the water. He, you know, he's defeated all of these things. You don't need to be afraid of them because there's another, you know, deity who's in charge of them. It literally like had this transformational effect on 100 things, you know, that it's so, yeah. So like, you don't want to just blindly assume that, you know, Western culture or Christian culture is like this, you know, perfect thing. But you do have to recognize that it's not just like this, you know, it's not that all cultures are equal or all beliefs about the world are equal and have, you know, all just the same beneficial impact. Like, that's just naive as well. And again, you just be colonial as well.
Colonialism cuts both ways.
Correct.
I have a friend who's a missionary as well. He's living in the jungle right now, introducing people. Like, he went back on to town and he made photocopies of this hymn book that they have in their little church, and they've had this book for 20 years, and it was the one book that they used for worship in this village for 20 years, and now everyone has a copy in the church. It's a huge, huge thing. But
I was thinking
of him reading this. Like, I think this book should be required reading for every missionary, just so they have some kind of framework to understand what they're doing to the people that they're working with. And, like, you know, I'm sure there have been people who have evaluated missionary work in this light and, you know, and see, like, from this perspective, the value that kind of missionary work does. But, like, being in the middle of that and not being aware of what the media are, of, like, having a helicopter and flying in, or of, you know, having to hike and cross rivers during flood season, just, like, what the implications of all these things are. I mean, he probably doesn't have time to sit around and think about stuff because he is so busy, but it seems really profitable.
And I do think, again, to this point of, like, it's not, like, it's easy to, because of principles of scarcity, right? It's easy to value that which you don't have. Like, and so it's easy to value, like, for these people who, you know, they've been in pre-literate cultures. Like, it's easy for them to, like, maybe it's going to be a temptation for them to, like, to, you know, far and above value this written medium now that they have it. Like, oh my gosh, like this is so much better than what we, it's like, no, it's not that it's better than what you, it's like, it's, again, it's the same thing. You need both of these things in concert. Like these things are not, you need both at the same time. Like they're both valuable. They're both, you know, incredibly necessary for healthy people. And so again, I think this is where the criticism can win. I think like we can get so, I don't know. Yeah. You can go wrong on either way. If you have a disproportionate emphasis on either way. And then these things to our other earlier point, like they can produce each other. You know, if you emphasize and have one thing for so long and you're not grateful for it, or you're not, you know, taking account for, you know, what does this exist for? It can be either, you know, it can be easy to just drift away from it in the way that, you know, the West seems to be doing, moving back to our pre-literate, pre-word-based existences.
Yeah, yeah. Any other interesting things that stood out to you? That he did have a chapter on money.
They did have the chapter on money. Yeah, we're gonna have to do like a whole Bitcoin episode. Maybe I'll have you on the Think After Bitcoin podcast, and we'll do the money chapter and talk about that, because there's a lot of things in this book that make me think about Bitcoin. But here on the roads and paper routes, that was an interesting chapter. He talks about like moving information, transportation, transportation as communication. I thought this was a brilliant idea. And so he says, like, before this, roads and written words were closely interrelated, right? So, like, again, if you're in a pre-digital world, like, any written thing is going to be written on something physical, and so it's going to need to be physically transported. And so, you know, you have something like the Roman roads that, you know, enabled that to happen more easily. But then he talks about, like, the role, like, at some point, I believe it was in England, like, I think it was England, their roads were built by the newspaper companies. And so it's like they wanted to make it easier for them to transport their newspapers, and so they were, you know, they had the right incentives for them to be the ones who were investing in the building of the roads. That was fascinating. The other one, it's on page 91, a lack of homogeneity in the speed of information movement creates diversity of patterns and organization. It's quite predictable then that any new means of moving information will alter any power structure whatever. So long as the new means is everywhere available at the same time, there is a possibility that the structure may be changed without breakdown. And so again, this obviously made me think of Bitcoin. You know, you have Bitcoin that gives the ability to move information and value anywhere in the world. And to this point, as long as it happens everywhere at once, I mean, everybody who has internet, we're halfway there. You know, everybody who has internet has access to this thing. And so, you know, can largely, at least to a large degree, be, you know, we can implement this change without there being breakdown. But yeah, just this, the other thing about this movement though, is like he says, with print, I'll just keep reading from where I left off, where there are great discrepancies in speeds of movement, as between air and road travel or between telephone and typewriter, serious conflicts occur within organizations. The metropolis of our time has become a test case for such discrepancies. If homogeneity of speeds were total, then it would be no rebellion and no breakdown, or there would be no rebellion and no breakdown. With print, political unity via homogeneity became feasible for the first time. In ancient Rome, however, there was only the light paper manuscript to pierce the opacity, or to reduce the discontinuity of the tribal villages. And when the paper supplies failed, the roads were vacated, as they were in their own age during gas rationing. Thus, the old city-state returned, and feudalism replaced republicanism. And so, like, this is the thing that's interesting about this is, like, where breakdowns occur in communication, whether those are communication of resources or communication of language, you have breakdowns and you have political breakdowns that happen. And so it's really interesting how, you know, the United States, you know, was a republic. It was founded as a republic. And yet, due to, you know, breakdowns in some of the money movement, Cantillon effect comes up, and there's a bunch of things that, you know, are relevant to this. But like, we're quickly moving financially, like monetarily, we're moving from a republic to a feudal state. Where like, you're quickly, you have things like BlackRock and Vanguard, these entities that own 25% of all the homes in the United States. It's either 20 or 25. I can't remember. But I mean, that's a feudal state. Like, we're quickly moving to that. And ironically, those houses are being purchased with money that belongs to everyday people. They're just from their retirement accounts. They're literally like selling themselves out to these entities. And you know, it's having it's beginning to have this same political change that we saw that McLuhan describes here. So that was both, I mean, fascinating and just like horrifying to think that's kind of the road that we're on.
That's really compelling, because I think that's accurate. But you also mentioned, you know, in ancient Rome, they could not maintain coherence because there wasn't printed media to keep people's ideals coherent. And so the printed newspaper was probably really instrumental in allowing America to span the continent and retain a national identity of some sort. Mm-hmm. But now with electricity and electrical communication, the internet, not only so that has two different effects. It has abbreviates space and time, but it also reduces the propositionality and linearity of our cultural formation. And so we're organizing less and less around propositions than around tribal identities. And that, I don't know how that coheres with feudalism, but you know, in the feudal Europe, your identity was mostly tied to who you served and whose land you lived on. It would be very interesting to see those align again. I don't really expect them to, but maybe investment conglomerates could be a vehicle for the aligning of like tribal values, because you see this with the parallel economy movement among conservatives. Like, we don't want BlackRock to own our houses. We want Elon Musk to own our houses.
Yeah. So it's like what in either case, in either, that's feudalism. Like, you have feudal lords who own everything. And again, some of this is it's not like we're not like actively choosing this. No one is like saying, you know, please, you know, govern me harder, Elon. You know, like, no, like, you're not saying this. It's just, this is how this based on the economic structure that we have, and based on, again, the money that we've chosen to use, that it comes with baked in incentives. It comes with baked in, you know, it has a telos to it that's going to produce a certain thing. And so if things keep going as they are, and BlackRock continues to accumulate money, and they continue to use some of that money to buy up houses, you're going to get to this point where, and we're already there to a large degree, you're going to have a housing crisis where, you know, people aren't going to be able to buy homes. And so again, like, this is, you're going to, now again, what can turn the tide of this? I think this is one of the things that we're excited about Bitcoin about, is because, like, if some of the monetary premium that's currently held in houses goes into Bitcoin, then all of a sudden houses are more free to be houses rather than speculative investment vehicles. And then, you know, you can potentially turn the tide on some of this. But
You know, these investment companies and stuff, the importance of virtue signaling is really, really obvious. Like, you know, BlackRock was behind a lot of the ESG sort of impetus. It's like, we're saving the world, we're being equitable. Yep. And that those are left wing values. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, like Elon Musk, he's not owning real estate yet, but he is creating like this everything app that is a bank and a social media, and it's like an identity provider. And projection of values.
Well, and his own projection of ESG stuff, like through, you know, electric cars, like he's pushing that from just like a different level. So I think there's just a ton of stuff. I mean, there's a ton of stuff you can get into. I'm trying to think. Anything else on your end?
Oh, I've got lots of underlined things, but I think that is probably a good place to leave it. We are still doing a whole second half of this book, and then an interview, and then I guess a Thank God for Bitcoin episode as well.
Correct.
So if you want more of this, there is more. And I definitely recommend reading this book. I don't know. Maybe I don't read enough books, but most of the books we've read on this podcast are just like, they're so good, and I consider a lot of them required reading to understand the world that we're in. You're losing a lot of the fidelity by us translating it. So
correct.
Jump in, please, and read McLuhan.
please value your own education enough to not just take our words for this stuff. I did think, I mean, this is a practice you should do with every book you're reading, but I think there's certain books that he quotes over and over again, and certain people, like there's the guy with the weird name, like something, it's like Ollie Noy or something.
Oh, I missed that one. He quotes James Joyce a ton, and it makes me want to try Finnegan's Wake again, but Finnegan's Wake is like, well, it has a reputation for being the most difficult book in existence to understand. I love his invocation of popular culture stuff. It's so fun. Like the beginning of the spoken word, he quotes a few seconds from a popular disc jockey show were typed out as follows. That's Patty Baby, and that's the girl with the dancing feet. And that's Freddie Cannon there on the David Mickey show in the nighttime. Ooba Scooby-Doo, how are you, boo-boo? Next we'll be swinging on a star and shwoo and sliding on a moonbeam.
Oh, John, we're going to put that on the beginning of this episode. We're going to just
cut it
and put it to music.
Cool. Well, I can't wait to apply this to social media and to the building of Noster because, you know, I was listening to a podcast this morning with Peter Lighthart that you turned me on to. Their most recent episode is about architecture and you know, the layout of cities and how to design cities. And, you know, like Aristotle's theories on politics and what's the best kind of city layout for building a politeia and all this stuff. And it's the same question that McLuhan's addressing, like, how do our houses and cities and homes and software affect us? Because software is really a home for our minds. We stare at this screen.
Yep.
The screen mediates on its own as well. But you know, the software that we use is actually a mediation. It's a medium as well. And so when we design these media, we should be sensitive of the home that we're creating that then shapes us. And I'd really, like, it's easy to talk in generalizations, but I'd really like to get into what the implications for that framework are and what we are specifically doing to ourselves. This is always the question that I am trying to answer on this podcast. And so, you know, this is another step towards that.
100% agreed. The name is Toynbee. Toynbee.
Toynbee. Well, it's
over and over again. I get to find out what this book is and then go from there. Cause he just quotes it to a James or Lewis Mumford. He quotes this book in the city and history. But yeah, shout out to Peter Lighthart. Shout out to James Wood. James is a friend. Peter is, I guess you can kind of be a friend. Like, you probably know Peter way better than I do. But
oh yeah, he used to be my pastor. He used to be my professor. He's great. He is probably the reason that I am asking these questions right now. 100%. Like, he introduced me to James Jordan. He introduced me to the study of hermeneutics. He's really, really pivotal in my understanding of the world and what I'm interested in.
Yeah. Go support the Civitas podcast. I know we don't do ads here, but we will do this free ad. They're not paying us anything, but yeah, the Civitas podcast is a really good one if you're interested in theology and I guess politics to a certain degree. But yeah, this has been another episode of the Thank God for Noster podcast, and we look forward to seeing you guys on Noster.
We'll see you on Noster.
Noster.
Noster.